Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. I'm sorry that we won't be able to do the program that we had planned for this morning. We were going to talk with David Orr. He's professor of environmental studies and politics at Oberlin College. And we're going to talk about environmental education in a kind of a broad way and about how even the design of a college campus can contribute to that. He was very important in constructing the Lewis Center for Environmental Studies there at Oberlin, said to be one of the first, if not the first, substantially green buildings on any college campus. Unfortunately, we were not able to hook up with him, but I'm sure that we can talk with him on another day, and maybe later on this month or next month we can get that into the schedule. So instead, we grab a show from the Focus 580 archives from a few weeks back. We hope you will enjoy hearing it, perhaps for the first time as you listen. So keep in mind that in this hour, we won't be taking phone calls. When the personal computer came along, it made the typewriter obsolete. Yet, in the minds and hearts of many, these cranky antiques still have an important place. And in fact, for a lot of people, the typewriter, the old-fashioned mechanical typewriter, still represents the idea of writing. There is, amazingly enough, a thriving market for old machines and parts, and some people have even made jewelry from old typewriter keys. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking a little bit about the development of the typewriter and how it shaped the creative process, and perhaps why it is that so many people are so nostalgic about this recently departed technology. And our guest for the program is Darren Werschler Henry. He is the author of a recently published book, which is titled The Iron Whim, A Fragmented History of Typewriting, and it is published by the Cornell University Press and has a lot of interesting facts and ideas in it. So if you're interested in writing or in the history of technology, particularly communications technologies, you might go out and take a look at the book. This is his most recent work of nonfiction. He's also written or co-written five other books about technology and culture. He has authored three books of poetry. He is assistant professor in the Communication Studies Department at Wilfrid Laurier University in Canada, in Ontario, Canada. He teaches courses on media history and new media. He also, for a number of years, was the senior editor at Coach House Books, which is a famous Canadian small press. Do a lot of interesting things, still do. You might take a look at their website if you have the opportunity. Among other things, it was the first press in the world that simultaneously published both full-text editions of its entire front list, both online and in paper at the same time. Well, hello, Mr. Werschler Henry. Hi.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, no problem.
You know, here at when I started working here, now low these many decades ago, and was doing news reporting, we wrote our stories on typewriters.
Yes.
And it was painful. It was really painful. I have never been a good typist. I'm not a touch typist, so I'm of the Hunt and Peck variety. And we had to make multiple copies, so that meant we had to use carbon paper. And I made a lot of mistakes, and it was painful for me and for the people who had to read my copy. So for me, I'm not going back. The idea of a typewriter being, you know, a subject of nostalgia, I think, phew, good riddance to them. I find it a little hard to that some people could wax nostalgic about the machines.
You know, it's funny. You're probably the first reporter that I've ever spoken to that isn't nostalgic about the typewriter. There was, in fact, just last week in Toronto at the Royal Ontario Museum, which is one of the largest museums in Canada, there was a new exhibit of antique typewriters from the collection of Martin Howard put on display. And one of his machines is featured on the cover of the U.S. edition of my book. And every newspaper in the country got the same bright idea at the same time. They all got some young journalist to sit down with a typewriter and to try to write a story about the event on the typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, they published pictures of the typescript, and they talked about how happy the people in the newsroom were to hear the clack of keys and all of the rest of it. And so one of these guys from the Globe and Mail phoned me up, and we had a very interesting and very long conversation about it. And he was quite surprised when I pointed out to him that this was actually, you know, a pretty well-established set of cultural cliches, that, you know, what he was experiencing, this kind of warm, fuzzy sense of the typewriter, was not only not unique to him, but, you know, pretty much endemic to everybody else who'd never really had to use a typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people like you who still have it, you know, scorched into their memory are definitely in the exception to the rule.
Well, it was a nightmare, and maybe that just says some. Maybe I'm not a real reporter. I don't know, but it was not a wonderful experience. And having now written on word processor, which can be a slightly more forgiving or at least assisting technology, I wouldn't go back if I had the opportunity. And actually, I'm not sure that anybody really would. If you said, okay, do you really would like to trade your word processor in for a manual typewriter? You really want to do that? I think probably most people would say, well, actually, no, I really wouldn't.
Yeah, well, we still have this kind of, you know, a well-established slot for cultural curmudgeons, you know, people like, you know, David Sedaris and Paul Auster have written very fondly about, you know, and these are contemporary figures, you know, who've written very fondly about typewriters and how they couldn't possibly use anything else and the perniciousness of the computer and so on and so forth. But, you know, partly that's, it's almost like playing a role in the larger, you know, on the larger stage of culture. Like, you have to have somebody who makes that argument to sort of throw how things work now into sharp relief. And I think that's a lot of where our current fascination with typewriters comes from, is when you're in the middle of something, like computing is still relatively new, and you know, as everybody knows who you know is in the middle of using a computer and, you know, conducting their lives on the internet, it's pretty hard to figure out what's going to happen next or how it's changing our lives one way or another. But typewriting is pretty clearly and definitively over, you know, and we can look back at it and we can say, okay, well, maybe there were some things that happened all of the time, and maybe there were some common elements that we can talk about in terms of how typewriting worked and how it changed our sense of ourselves and of writing and of culture in general.
Yeah. I do think that it's interesting that, you know, I'm sure probably most, when there were typewriters, most of the typewriters were in some sort of business setting, and what people were doing was not art, but that we have this association particularly between journalism and fiction writing and the typewriter, to the point where, as I think you note in the book, if you go into a bookstore and you start looking at the covers of books and start counting the number of book covers that have a picture of an old typewriter on them, it's somehow just identification of the activity of writing, that is of perhaps of creative writing, and that machine that,
yeah,
it's still still very potent.
Yeah, and that's where the nostalgia, you know, kind of, you know, clouds our collective memory, is the difference between the experience of, you know, hundreds of people working in a newsroom or working in a large firm somewhere managing, you know, all of the documents that the Industrial Revolution and the first sort of wave of globalization at the beginning of the 19th century brought about, because that was the condition of typewriting for most people when it came into existence. It was what made that new business world work, and the people that were typing were usually women, and they usually didn't make very much money, and they were almost always typing at the behest of someone else and didn't have a lot of say in terms of what they were typing. But our cultural memory, you know, in terms of the kinds of book covers that you were just talking about, or you know, pretty much any period film that you can rent, you'll invariably get to this scene where, you know, there's some guy, usually, again, you know, not a woman, sitting at a desk with his sleeves rolled up, and there's a single bare light bulb and probably a bottle of whiskey at his elbow, and he's hammering away late into the night on, you know, this kind of impassioned document that, you know, is supposed to tell us the truth about something. And, you know, typewriting almost never was that, and for the people who thought about it that way, you know, there's this kind of you know, convenient omission of the fact that they were actually in a kind of privileged position.
Mm-hmm. I do. I guess one of the things that I think about is, though, how that device and whatever kind of technology you're using does mediate the act. I think, for example, I think maybe some people will know the story of how it is that we get this strange configuration of keys, that is where the letters are, and that keyboard that we're still using, the QWERTY one, and it's called that because that's what that first letter spells, Q-W-E-R-T-Y, was developed actually to slow typists down because they were going so fast. The machine was jamming up, so the keyboard was actually designed to be a problem. So, you know, in a sense, some people I suppose would argue that makes you go slower, and that somehow that makes the business of composition slightly more deliberate, and that some people, I guess, would argue that the problem with the word processor is it's almost too easy, and that is people write things without thinking enough about them. Certainly that's the case with email. And I wonder what you make of all of that, just the physical reality of the machine, and does that indeed impinge on how it is you write?
Yeah, I mean, there are a whole bunch of really sort of juicy ideas all rolled up in there that, you know, we've got to spend some time unpacking. And, you know, the first one and the one that, we're all indebted to Marshall McLuhan for is the idea that the particular technology that you happen to be using at the moment is going to have a lot to do with what you can say and how you can say it. People wrote differently on typewriters than they wrote on computers. The physical conditions of the production of writing were different, and so, you know, we wrote different kinds of things. It was true of the pen as well, you know, and people will still talk about this, you know. When people say, oh, well, you know, I prefer to sit down and write with a pen in my journal, they probably have good reason for saying that, because they will write differently than they would on a computer. So that's the first thing. And then the second question is, you know, well, how different is using a typewriter from using a computer? And there are a couple of important differences. You know, the first one is that, and I think this is part of the reason that people are still nostalgic for typewriting, is you hit a typewriter key and a lever moves and a hammer comes down and some ink gets put onto a piece of paper, and you can see this mechanical process going all the way through the machine. You can't see that with a computer. You have no idea what's going on when you hit a key, because that key can be programmed to do anything. It doesn't necessarily have any direct connection to the letter in the way that a typewriter key did. And of course, the second thing about computers is you can network them together, and you can't really do that with typewriters. So the way that we produce text is totally different. That being said, the process of learning to type and the deliberateness of it and its relationship to the keyboard is also pretty complex. The only thing that we really know for sure about how the QWERTY keyboard was developed is that Christopher Latham Sholes, the man who sort of perfected the version of the typewriter that we all sort of think about as the typewriter now, although there were, you know, dozens, perhaps even hundreds of other competing models that were, you know, equally as effective, is that he was related to a school teacher, and he asked him to give him a list of letter pairs that were commonly used together, and some of them he split up so that, as you suggested, you know, the keys wouldn't jam when people typed quickly. But really, for touch typists and speed typists, the only way that you can type over about 70 words a minute is if you literally do not know what it is that you're typing. Your hands are moving so quickly, and they're soaking up, you know, information that your eyes are feeding your hands, that you can't actually remember what you're typing when you're typing quickly. So, you know, the argument that there's a deliberateness to typing only holds as long as you're not typing quickly. So, you know, you start to tease these things apart, and again, you know, there are rules there, but it gets very complex very quickly.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Darren Wershler-Henry. He's assistant professor in the Communication Studies Department at Wilfrid Laurier University. That's in Canada. He is a writer, critic, a former senior editor of Coach House Books. He's the author of a number of books. He's published several collections of poetry, and his most recent is this book that looks at the typewriter, something of its history and cultural impact. His book is titled The Iron Whim, A Fragmented History of Typewriting. It's published by Cornell University Press, and apparently the title is drawn from Marshall McLuhan, a man whose name you mentioned a little while ago. The medium is the message man. What did he mean by that? The Iron Whim.
Well, in one of McLuhan's most famous books, Understanding Media, the chapter that he wrote on the typewriter is called Into the Age of the Iron Whim, and I was really sort of puzzled by this initially, because it's this kind of dense, almost poetic phrase, the kind of phrase that McLuhan loved, because he was very interested in people like James Joyce and in the ability of poets and fiction writers to use, you know, metaphor and allusion to describe things. In one sense, I think what he meant is that the typewriter sort of took your most kind of, you know, whimsical gesture and put it in this very kind of concrete and indelible form. So that was the first sort of thing that came to mind. And the second thing was that in the 19th century, a whim was a synonym for a gizmo or a gewgaw or some sort of fanciful piece of machinery. And, you know, when it first appeared, the typewriter was exactly that. And the third thing is a very kind of direct and mechanical definition. A whim is in a system where you've got a mine shaft or a well or something that's powered by animals, and there's like a vertical shaft and then a number of perpendicular rods sticking out from it, so you get this kind of wheel arrangement, and you turn the wheel to make the shaft go, which, you know, powers a piece of machinery. That's that arm that sticks out radially is called a whim. And the earliest designs for typewriters, many of them were sort of based on this whim-like model, where you had the keys arranged radially in a circle, or the keys arranged around the edge of a circle, and you rotated the circle so that the letter was over the place that you wanted the character to type on the paper, and then you pressed the key directly down. So I think, you know, McLuhan being McLuhan, he probably had most, if not all, of those things in mind when he picked that title. So it's a nice kind of crunchy, poetic title, and it can mean a lot of things at once.
Yeah, and if people can't picture that, they need to go out to the bookstore, because throughout the book there are pictures and lithographs, I guess, or engravings of various designs of the typewriter, some of them looking very strange, and there is one of this particular one that comes from the 1840s, that design of this wheel with the keys, and the wheel turns around and you position it over the paper where you want the letter to be, and then you push that key down. So you're moving the whole apparatus rather than kind of just moving the paper. The thing that has the keys on it moves.
Yeah. I mean, early typewriter designs are really kind of strange and alien looking when you look back at them now. Of course, you know, famously, when David Cronenberg made his movie version of Naked Lunch, he plays that up to the limit and actually turns the typewriters in the movie into these kinds of, you know, horrible, strange creatures that, you know, do the writing for writers instead of, you know, being the thing that you know, the writers operate.
Yeah.
In terms of you know, what's valuable today for typewriter collectors, the stranger a machine looks, the more it's actually worth. And you know, what that points out is that the typewriter that we ended up with, that we think of, you know, commonly as this kind of, you know, very logical and very sane piece of machinery that developed in this very orderly way, is actually a kind of collection of, you know, dead ends and compromises and flukes, really. Just because that's the machine that we ended up with didn't mean that there were other perfectly useful and functional alternatives.
We have a caller. Why don't we bring them in? I will not make them wait any longer. Someone who's listening in Robinson. This is on our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Yes, David. I've heard you and your guest express various opinions about the placement of the letters on the keyboard, and I am unconvinced. Many years ago, I had a, quote, epiphany about that and realized or thought that it was done purely by chance, in tune to the children's song, learning the alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. You'll see that those first letters are given to the left hand and the right hand pretty randomly.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Yeah, Darren, any comment on that?
Well, I mean, I never suggested anything otherwise. I said all we really know about the QWERTY keyboard is that there were certain letter pairs that happen fairly close together in the English alphabet that are reasonably far apart on the keyboard. And people have been fighting about how the rest of the letters ended up on in the order that they did for a very long time. None of the theories that have been advanced really seem to hold up under scrutiny. Some people have suggested that the keys were arranged according to the order that you find lead in a typesetter's case, and that's not true. Most of the alternatives to the keyboard that we have now were designed so that the most common letters in the English language would be under the fingers that you hold on the middle row, which is not true now. Like for a QWERTY keyboard, a surprising number of the letters that we use all of the time, ETAOINSHRDLU are the most common letters in English usage in that order. And a lot of those letters fall under the left hand and, you know, particularly around the little fingers, which is, you know, for most people is not their strong hand and is not the, even, you know, under the strongest part of the hand. So, you know, I'm sure the battles about how that arrangement came about will continue to rage on. And you know, I'm certainly interested in hearing anything that anybody has to say about it.
Okay, fine. I can appreciate your position. However, I could adduce one strong combination of English letters, the past tense letters E and D, which, in not being placed far apart, are inconveniently close and error-provoking.
Yeah, well, I guess the question is there's where the keys are on the keyboard, but there's also, you know, where the hammers would be arranged in a row, and, you know, perhaps, you know, I'd have to look at the mechanics of a typewriter, right? Like if you hit a key on a row above it, where is that hammer in terms of the arrangement inside the machine? Like,
okay.
that's the question.
Good. I hadn't considered that thought. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's go here to someone locally here in Champaign-Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. Any authors besides Hemingway who supposedly preferred typing? And what about the numbers on a computer keyboard versus the arrangement of numbers for a phone and the Dvorak keyboard, which supposedly allowed faster typing?
Okay, well, let's start with Hemingway. I mean, Hemingway was I thought a lot about Hemingway when I was writing this book, because a friend of mine, a fiction writer, pointed out to me that Hemingway was so superstitious about his typewriter that if he was working on a manuscript and he got stuck on it, he would actually put the typewriter with the page on it aside rather than remove the page from the typewriter and start working on another machine. So I always thought that was a great story. I talk a lot about writers and their relationship to the machine. I talk about Henry James, who was one of the important or early users of the typewriter. I talk about Jack Kerouac, who, in terms of American literature, is really important in terms of his relationship to the typewriter. And they're all quite different. You know, like the way that Kerouac used the typewriter was very, very different than the way that Henry James used it. But in each case, there was a very, very specific outcome from, you know, writing using a machine as opposed to, say, you know, trying to write longhand. In terms of the way that the numbers are arranged as opposed to the way that you'd find them on a telephone, well, again, like the further back you go in terms of typewriter history, the more novel arrangements you'll find in terms of keys. And there are typewriters where you can find not just the numbers, but all of the letters on a kind of dial arrangement where you actually press little buttons. And I think, you know, you can probably find fairly easily instances where people thought, well, you know, the telephone's a pretty intuitive, pretty easy-to-use device. Maybe we should try that for writing as well as just for dialing. So I think you're sort of right to be interested in, you know, the relationship of typewriters to other kinds of technologies of the day.
Well, you know, I'm looking at one here, and there are, as I said throughout the book, there are photographs of different odd designs of typewriters, and I'm just looking at one here that I just marvel at, that I've never seen anything like this before. This is a typewriter that has a keyboard that looks like a piano keyboard. And I just I like that a lot for the strange combinations of the two things. And then also, I guess it you know, maybe makes starts you thinking about one of the things that appeals to people about the typewriter is that it does make a music of a sort. It makes a sound, and I like this idea of the piano keyboard being the thing that you're playing the keys to write with.
Yeah, and that's an analogy that many, many people have drawn on over the years. The initial patent application for the Scholes typewriter was basically just a single key connected to a single piano key connected to you know, the moving arm that has the type on it in the typewriter. I think initially it was one of the ways that people tried to familiarize the general public with the typewriter was by making analogy of the piano, which was already a pretty comfortable part of life in the late 19th century. I mean, there are some obvious differences, like you never use cords on a typewriter, and you don't have foot pedals on the typewriter, at least not after, you know, the kind of initial models. So the differences become evident fairly quickly, but there are entire books that have been written by people who are typists and jazz pianists, for example, and you know, trying to work through the way that they use a keyboard on a piano versus the way that they use it on a typewriter. And for that matter, there's music that's been composed on typewriters. So you know, it's a kind of rich point of comparison, and all kinds of interesting things when you start looking at analogies and points of crossover between, you know, the typewriter and, you know, the other technologies of the day.
Yeah. You mentioned it earlier that one of the writers that you talk about in the book connected with the typewriter is Henry James. And I guess the story about James is he dictated his writing to a typist who typed as he spoke. And the story apparently was he got so used to that sound that for him to get going, to get composing, someone would have to bang on a typewriter. It wouldn't matter if they were writing something. It was just the sound of the typing. He had to somehow have that sound, at least so it said, to be able to start composing himself.
Yeah, and again, that's fairly common when you start looking at what other writers have said about their typewriters. You know, the idea that working in a newspaper office is invigorating because of the clack of typewriters is making a similar kind of argument. Again, you can see that very clearly in something like Cronenberg's film with Naked Lunch, where the typewriter says to the William Burroughs character, "I'm going to dictate some words to you that I'd like you to type into me," and he sort of says, "Okay, sure, what the hell," and you know, hilarity ensues. That was one of the things that I was sort of looking for over and over again when people talked about their relationship to their typewriter, was whether or not there was any sort of sense that the typewriter was telling them what to do, and in many cases, there is. And the way that I sort of the way that I talk about that in the book is as this relationship of dictation that's always there, whether we acknowledge it or not, because all of our ideas come from somewhere else. Whether you're sitting alone at a typewriter, you know, waiting for inspiration, you know, what are you doing if not waiting for something that you've forgotten or half remembered or that somebody told you once? It's not all that different than, you know, sort of sitting there and listening to somebody tell you what to type.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Darren Wershler Henry. He is assistant professor in the Communication Studies Department at Wilfrid Laurier University. He's also a writer, critic, former senior editor of Coach House Books. He's the author of a number, has published several collections of poetry, and the book that we are talking about this morning, if you would like to look at it, is The Iron Whim, A Fragmented History of Typewriting, and it's published by the Cornell University Press. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free, 800-222-9455. You know, nowadays we have these small pocket-sized devices that we call calculators that you can use to do some fairly sophisticated number crunching. But there was a time when a calculator was not an object, it was a person. And in fact, it was a woman. And if you were doing number crunching and you had to do a lot of it, what you do is you'd get yourself a whole room full of calculators. And those were women who sat down at a desk or a table with paper and pen and actually did the figuring for you. And there, in a similar way, there probably would have been a time when if you said typewriter, you weren't talking about the device, you were talking about a person. You were talking about a woman who sat there at the machine, and as a man dictated, she typed the script. And this gets into all sorts of interesting things about men, women, and typing.
Yeah, it does very quickly, in fact, because one of the problems was okay, for people who are trying to market typewriters, we have this machine, but we don't know who's going to use it or how are we going to introduce it into the workforce if we don't have, you know, people already trained. So immediately organizations like the YWCA started training typists, and when you went to buy a typewriter in the late 19th century, we went to buy the machine, but often the operator sort of came along with it as your responsibility. And there are some kind of interesting moments in you know, literary and journalistic history as a result of that, when Mark Twain talks about seeing the typewriter for the first time, and he was one of the first authors to get seriously enamored of a typewriter. His book Life on the Mississippi is often cited as the first typewritten literary manuscript. But he tells this story about going into a typewriter store and seeing this machine, and they're looking at it, and magically in the narrative there's this woman all of a sudden who had, like, she hasn't been mentioned at all, and all of a sudden she's there doing the typing for Twain and his friend, and he takes the typewriter home, and lo and behold, he has this typist that came along with him. And historically how that worked is of course these women were often very poorly paid, and their relationship to the workforce was such that opportunities for advancement, you know, were often quite slim. But it did change things in terms of the way that the office worked forever. And one of the things that happened was this kind of odd sexualization of the workplace and of the machinery of typing in particular. And there were all kinds of vaudeville jokes at the time about, you know, the boss phoning home to his wife and saying, well, I'll be home in a couple of hours. I'm just sitting here with my typewriter in my lap. And, of course, he's talking about the woman. He's not talking about his machine. So one of the things that I found that I thought was quite fascinating was a whole collection of Tijuana Bibles, these little pornographic comic books from the late 19th and early 20th century, and a huge number of them sort of, you know, featured these racy stories about typists and their machines and you know, all of the kinds of, you know, sexual connotations that you know, are still part of the language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it's interesting. I wouldn't have thought it, because certainly there it had been women in the workforce, and there had been women who worked in factories and so forth. But I'd say you probably make the argument that that one device that was responsible for bringing very large numbers of women into the workforce was the typewriter.
Yeah. I mean, that certainly seems to be the historical argument, and there are a number of people that have written extensively on women and their relationship to typewriting, and that moment where all of a sudden there are simply more requirements for workers than there are men to fill the jobs has a lot to do with the introduction of the typewriter into the workforce.
And that also, it's interesting then to go back to this, again, this idea we have about writers, particularly journalists and fiction writers and typewriters, and that being an important tool, and to the extent that you even think of them together, you see an old typewriter, you think about that kind of stereotypic depictions of writers, where here the writer has his hands on the keys, that for when it was introduced in the workplace, and you know, maybe for a lot of its history in the workplace, the person who had her hands on the keys was the typewriter, but was not she was just, in a sense, almost an extension of the machine. She wasn't the one who was doing the composing. She was putting it down on the page, but it was generally speaking, a man who was generating the text, and then she was responsible for using the machine to transfer it to the paper.
Yeah, and again, that's something that in, you know, sort of recent literary theory and history, there's been a lot of unpacking around that, because it is vitally important to remember, you know, the conditions that those books were produced under, and you know, to go back to Henry James and his secretary Theodora Boston Kay. I mean, the interesting thing about that particular relationship and Boston Kay's position as James's typist is, long after Henry James died, she was still receiving typewritten communiques from the ghost of Henry James, like for decades after James died. When you look at the writing, the interesting thing is it's all about this sort of incredible desire to be accepted as a writer with something to say. This moment of you know, sort of cultural acknowledgement that was a long time coming, and it's been a hard fought battle for women writers, women scholars, you know, women working in the office, and you know, for, you know, many people, you know, will of course still make the argument that, you know, that's a battle that's a long way from being over.
Mm. That I guess that I like that story about the ghost of James continuing to dictate after death. I guess that also plays nicely into that idea of the machine somehow being haunted, or that it's the machine itself. It's the ghost in the machine. You know, it's that kind of idea that it's speaking. There's some spirit here that's using that as the way, and so that somehow the writer is just sometimes almost secondary.
Yeah, there are. When you start looking into the history of typewriting, there are dozens and dozens of stories of haunted typewriters, and you know, for that matter, pretty much every media technology that came into existence at the end of the 19th century was, you know, haunted in some way. The American interest in spiritualism and the period where, you know, the typewriter, the telegraph, the telephone, all of those technology, the motion picture camera, all of them come into being at the same time as this sort of interest in spiritualism. And it makes a certain kind of sense when you think about it, you know, like, well, if we can use this technology to communicate with people on the other side of the world who may or may not still be alive by the time they get our message, maybe we can use it to communicate with the dead, you know. So for every communication technology, there was a period where somebody tried to use it to communicate with the spirit world. And when you don't know what a machine does, and you know you don't really know the limits of what is or isn't possible, you know, it's a legitimate question. So I think, you know, again, in retrospect, these things that sort of initially seem puzzling, that we might think about typewriters as haunted in some way, start to make a lot of sense when you look back at the historical record and you look at what else was going on at the time.
Mm. We have a couple of other callers here in Urbana. Let's talk with them. Line one, in fact, here in Urbana.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
I want to come back to those legions of women in front of their typewriters. I think that the computer has not made life particularly better for those.
So yeah, I would.
Because, well, A, they now have to put out much more production for relatively not any more money in today's dollars. They expect perfection. They have more health problems. You didn't get carpal tunnel syndrome with your Remington Noiseless.
Yeah, so, I mean, there were other kinds of physical ailments that came along with it, but I definitely agree with your point. The last chapter of the book is sort of all about typing after the typewriter, and one of the things that I talk about is how typing works in the global economy. You know, you can have people working around the clock now because you just, you know, shoot your work over into the next time zone, or you find people that you can outsource to who are willing to work for even less money and, you know, under even worse conditions than they would be otherwise. So it's all the ironies around, you know, the question of technology and emancipation are pretty strong. G.K. Chesterton used to say that women refused to be dictated to, so they went out and became typists. His point was that you make advances in one area and you lose things in another. The global work economy around computing is definitely at least as problematic as it was with typing.
And I think that we use more paper.
Yeah, I think that's true too. You know, there was all this talk about the paperless office, and we certainly churn out a lot more of it than we used to.
Misplaced comma, and you turn out a whole new page.
That's right.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you. We have someone else to talk with in Urbana. This is line two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that some older people have trouble using a computer, but they can still use a typewriter. I'm wondering, is it really a technology that can be improved on, you know, for older people who have cognitive problems, you know, following the logic of the software and a computer? And, you know, is there any effort being made to address those people?
Well, I think so. I mean, one of the things about a typewriter is a typewriter being made out of, you know, iron and steel is not capable of adapting to you. You adapt to it. And that's what typing classes were all about. You have to sit in a certain way. You have to hold your hands in a certain way. You have to look at the paper in a certain way. So, you know, basically we adapted our bodies to the dictates of the technology of the time. And while that's true in different ways of computers, computers also have things like the ability to print letters in large type on the screen, or the ability to use voice commands instead of a keyboard. So there are, I think there are ways in which the computer is more amenable to different kinds of accessibility than the typewriter, but that doesn't mean that, you know, as you suggested, that it doesn't bring its own problems along with it.
Well, I agree. I mean, just what I've noticed with not all older people, but some older people, they just trouble following the logic, you know, that you have to have when you're trying to follow a particular software program and get it to work.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And it just seems that that's not something that is really being addressed by the people who, you know, write 35 million lines of code.
Yeah,
I
think, you know, the typewriter, again, it's something that if you grew up with it, you sort of understood it implicitly. It's part of your culture. And there's been a kind of cultural break, and computers work according to a very different kind of logic, and people who've grown up with them have an easier time of it. But, you know, I know I've met a number of kids who have no idea what a typewriter is. Their friends, you know, my friends bring their kids over to my house, and they find the old typewriter up at the top of the stairs, and they have no idea what it is or what it sounds like. There's some sort of vague sense that it might be related to a computer because it has a keyboard, but beyond that, you know, it's kind of alien to them. So I think that's part of this kind of cultural shift that we've been experiencing for the last 25 or 30 years. And, you know, there are things that people have done to try to ameliorate that, but there are going to be all kinds of things that you know, a lot of us are just not going to be able to figure out about computers, regardless of our age.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go again to another person. This is also someone in Urbana, line 3. Hello?
Is it my turn?
Yes.
I have two old typewriters, and I was wondering if you have any advice about how to find out if they're worth anything, and if so, how much, and how to find somebody who collects them or would like to buy them.
Well, there are a couple of things you can do. One of them is there are typewriter collectors all over the Internet. If you start doing web searches for antique typewriters, you'll start finding those sites very, very quickly. And typewriter collectors are fantastic sources of knowledge. They have they've made all kinds of information available about what's valuable and what isn't, and their sites are usually full of pictures. So that's one of the quickest ways of doing it. There are a number of books on typewriter collecting and what is and what isn't valuable, so you could try the library. And the third thing is you could look at what's for sale on eBay, because eBay is constantly full of people selling typewriters, you know, ranging from, you know, a few years old to a couple of hundred years old.
A couple hundred? Are there any that are 200 years old?
Some of them are, yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, there are. The history of typewriting stretches back over a couple of centuries.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, I'm totally fascinated by it, and I think, you know, when it's one of those things that the typewriter is still so near and dear to so many of us that, you know, when I started telling people I was working on this book, one of the first things that I noticed was people started saying to me, you know, I got an old typewriter in the basement, and I just realized very, very quickly that, you know, this was something that was fascinating enough on a large enough scale that it merited further investigation.
Do you have a collection of typewriters?
No, I don't. I know typewriter collectors, and I am totally willing to sort of cede expertise in that aspect of this to them, because I'm interested in the way that typewriting worked, not in the history of the machine, because there are a lot of people that have investigated that to a greater extent and you know, far better than I ever could.
Mm. So what was the first one invented? You said it's 200 years ago?
Oh, well, you can go all the way back to...
Who invented that one?
You can go back to the 18th century, and the first thing that sort of looks like a patent for a writing machine was for a man in England named Henry Mill. And unfortunately, we don't have any pictures. We just have a description of this writing machine. So that's usually where typewriter historians start. But there were all kinds of moments between then and now where people tried to invent machines for the blind or the deaf, or people tried to invent these things that were really kind of elaborate clockwork toys that would write on their own, and those were usually invented for members of the European aristocracy as a kind of amusement. And a lot of them actually have a lot more to do with computers than with typewriting. But all of these things, and people who were trying to make improvements in terms of small portable printing presses, so all of those things were feeding into this desire to produce a kind of writing machine that was portable and usable by anyone and cheap. So there, if you're interested in it at all, I would really urge you to start, you know, looking around the internet and digging into your local library, because there are many, many books on the subject, and I suspect you'll find them as fascinating as I do.
Oh, well, thank you. This is so interesting. Thank you very much.
Thanks
and
for the call.
Luck.
We are down to about 3-4 minutes. You make a sort of complicated and subtle argument I'd like to have you talk at least a little bit about the relationship between the typewriter and writing. And we've talked about the fact, and certainly people can appreciate the fact, that writing with paper and pen, writing with a typewriter, writing with a word processor, each of those is physically a different act. And certainly people have written about how that ends up affecting the content. That is, you know, the fact that it's a physical act does indeed have something to do with what one ends up writing. And I think you make the argument that the typewriter in particular kinds of ways is a constraint, that somehow it constrains what one writes, and that then again, once we come to the word processor, that starts to open things up again. Is that something that in a couple of minutes that you can talk about?
Sure. I mean, and again, anybody who's ever sort of sat in a typing class knows that there's all kinds of discipline involved in learning how to use a typewriter, in the same way that there is in learning how to drive a car. You know, there are rules about how you're supposed to use this machine to produce certain kinds of effects that we all agree are beneficial. You know, by disciplining yourself, you learn how to do anything from learning how to dance to, say, operating your typewriter. But the thing that a lot of people forget is that discipline isn't always a negative term. Discipline means that we're constrained in certain kinds of ways, but it also gives us the ability to do other kinds of things. It makes us productive, and it enables us to do things that, you know, perhaps the people who taught us how to type, you know, didn't necessarily have in mind. You know, when Jack Kerouac was an amazing touch typist, he could type, you know, well over 100 words a minute, but I don't think his typing teacher ever really expected him to write on the road. Unexpected things happen as a result of those kinds of systems of discipline and constraint. And the thing that fascinated me and continues to fascinate me is when you look at something like typewriting as a whole, the question of what is and what isn't possible to do with that machine, what is and what isn't possible to say, is really, in the end, what produces innovation and new inventions, because it's the people who are pushing at the edges of what is or isn't possible to say that end up producing something that's truly new and truly unique. You know, those are the moments I think that, you know, we're all drawn to as a culture. Those are the kinds of things that I'd like to explore in computing and you know, a variety of other kinds of technologies as well.
Mm-hmm. Just as a matter of wild speculation, and maybe I read too much science fiction, but what would you think of the idea, if one could, of directly connecting your brain to the machine so that what you could do is think what you wanted to write and it would write it?
Well, that's the dream, right? Like, that's
right.
always
right.
since Plato, That's been the dream, like perfect communication, the machine that will write exactly what I think and you will understand it in exactly the way that I want you to understand it. The other side of that has always been the idea of total loss, right? That, you know, I'm typing this document and no one is going to have any idea what I'm arguing or why. And I think, you know, the truth for any communication technology is always about how you negotiate between the two of those. You hope for perfect understanding and you reconcile yourself to loss. And, you know, the history of communication technologies is the history of people sort of zigzagging between those two poles.
Well, it's a very interesting book, and I think that people will find a lot in it to think about, both in terms of thinking about the technology and how the technology developed and what sort of effect that had on culture, and then also this relationship between the technology and the writer and how that either facilitates or gets in the way. So it's really interesting. The book, once again, is titled The Iron Whim. The subtitle is A Fragmented History of Typewriting. It's published by the Cornell University Press by our guest, Darren Wershler. Henry, he is assistant professor in the Communication Studies Department at Wilfrid Laurier University. He teaches courses on media history and new media and has also written a number of books about technology and culture. And thanks very much for giving us some of your time.
You're welcome, David. It's been a pleasure.